This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You know, there's a story about the British novelist Anthony Trollope. Trollope apparently wrote so quickly and so efficiently that when he'd finish a novel at, say, 9 in the morning, he'd write the end, and then he'd write the first sentence 15 minutes later of the very next book. But most writers these days give themselves at least a little break between books, and that's exactly when I caught up with Zadie Smith.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry. I'm going to take my jacket off. We'll see what occurs. It's a good time for fiction, though, don't you think? I feel like, I don't know, I'm doing a lot of reading, and it seems like a good time.
Are you? What are you reading?
Lots of girls, Alexandra Kleeman, Natessa Moshfegh. I don't know, it seems like an exciting time.
So you really keep up?
Well, not normally, because I'm working, but when I finish working, I
You go on a binge?
Yeah. Joy Williams.
One reason it's always great to talk to Zadie Smith is, and forgive the bad cliche, she's just someone who's got her finger on the pulse. She's been writing entertaining but very serious books dealing with race and ethnicity and gender for a long time now, a decade and a half. Her first bestseller, it's amazing to remember, was White Teeth when she was 24. She's written essays about how we feel about global warming, and recently she wrote about Brexit, a very sad and moving piece about how Britain has profoundly changed. And she's published personal essays and some terrific short stories, of course, in The New Yorker. Her new novel, Swing Time, is her first in 4 years.
The book is about two girls who meet when they're about 7 years old in a dance class. But I thought about it as a kind of fable about blackness. That's really how I thought about it. And actually, when I just finished this book, Homegoing, by Yar Gyasi, who is, I think, almost half my age. And I saw, even though the novels don't have anything plot-wise in common, it seemed to me the same instinct. Like, she sat down to write a novel about the entirety of the diaspora in this incredible intensification, 300 pages she does it in. Mine is longer and looser. But I was trying to imagine the idea of one life somehow thematically speaking for a lot of different lives.
Why did you settle on dancing as a motor for this?
For the same kind of essentialist reasons. I was thinking of something I connect deeply with the communal experience of blackness, and dance is one of those things, I realize. Mm. Whenever I'm thinking about race, I always think of it exactly on that line of generalization. So we are thought of as a certain kind of people with certain kind of qualities, whether you're Jewish or black or Irish. And those things are both what is held against you and also what you hold close. It's on such a strange border. You hate to be stereotyped, right, or generalized, and yet the borders by which you mark your community are exactly about the things that you have in common or you consider shared across this great diaspora. That line is where I'm always writing to, that strange double edge.
I want you to, if you would, I'd love to have you read from the novel where your narrator, the unnamed narrator, is meeting her close friend Tracy.
Sure. My mind was on Tracy and on the soles of her ballet shoes, upon which I now read Freed, clearly stamped in the leather. Her natural arches were two hummingbirds in flight, curved in on themselves. My own feet were square and flat, they seemed to grind through the positions. I felt like a toddler, placing wooden blocks at a series of right angles to each other. "Flutter, flutter, flutter," said Isabel. "Yes, that's lovely, Tracy." Compliments made Tracy throw her head back and flare her little pig nose awfully. Aside from that, she was perfection, I was besotted. Her mother seemed equally infatuated. Her commitment to those classes seemed the only consistent feature of what we would now call her parenting. She came to class more than any other mother, and while there, her attention rarely wavered from her daughter's feet. My own mother's focus was always elsewhere. She could never simply sit somewhere and let time pass. She always had to be learning something. She might arrive at the beginning of class with, say, the black Jacobins in hand, and by the time I came over to ask her to swap my ballet shoes for tap, she'd already be 100 pages through. Later, when my father took over, he either slept or went for a walk, the parental euphemism for smoking in the churchyard. At this early stage, Tracy and I were not friends or enemies or even acquaintances. We barely spoke. Yet there was always this mutual awareness, an invisible band strung between us, connecting us, and preventing us from straying too deeply into relations with others. Technically, I spoke more to Lily Bingham, who went to my school, and Tracy's own standby was sad old Danica Babich, with her ripped tights and thick accent. She lived on Tracy's corridor. But though we giggled and joked with these white girls during class, and although they had every right to assume that they were our focus, our central concern, that we were to them the good friends we appeared to be, as soon as it came to break time and squash and biscuits, Tracy and I lined up next to each other. Every time, it was almost unconscious, two iron filings drawn to a magnet.
Female friendship is at the absolute center of this book. Can you talk a little bit about that? That seems to be a subject that's not only yours for the moment, but it's certainly Ferrante's and others. Why now?
I was thinking about that too. In two areas, like, it's structural. It's to do with the fact, to me, that women are, with families, are writing more than they have in human history. And one of the things which is very important in female life is this relationship. I don't know a woman who hasn't had these intense childhood friendships with which she still has a kind of ambivalent or stressful reaction to. But we never heard of them because men were writing these books for the most part. And women, when they began to write en masse, had this feeling of inhibition, like, well, which stories will matter? I certainly, when I wrote White Teeth, wrote somewhat in drag, I think, right? You write with the idea of, well, what is a story? And the story is certainly about, there are men at the center of that story and a masculine conception, I think. To feel free, you need to have examples of it before you and space. And I think what's happening now is a lot of women writers feeling something of that freedom, that their subjects are not small or domestic or uninteresting, that they are to the material of the novel.
Sadie, I think this is a departure for you in a technical term. You're writing this book in first person.
Right.
Why did you resist that before?
A bit of British snobbery, probably, and
or British reluctance.
Reluctance and misunderstanding of what the form is. Like, once I started writing in it, I saw all these possibilities.
Well, explain to an American listener why there is a snobbery at all in not writing in first person.
I think I've been writing about this recently, thinking about it. I think it's about Shakespeare, actually, the root of it, because we're told from a very young age that Shakespeare is the greatest writer in the world. Not coincidentally from England, and that his greatness is exactly this negative capability, right? This incredible broad act of empathy. In his ideal mode, he is both a black man and a Jew and a woman and an old man and a child and etc. And this is idealized in British life, I think, as the aim of literature, which is a kind of ethical and aesthetic confusion in my view, but one that I was very much under as a student. And the first person, I think, is considered an indulgence or something bordering on the memoiristic or, you know, or certainly I did think of it that way, I think. Huh. And also basically limited, like if you're just talking about how you feel, what about everybody else in the picture? But that's a very infantile idea of the first person.
So when you set out in first person, did you find it liberating or the opposite?
I thought it was a tool that could be used. Like, it's a literary effect among many others. Like, when I read, when you read Nausgaard or Ferrante or people genuinely writing straight memoir, there is the idea on the reader's part that this is in some way more authentic, right? That's the That's the idea. But the writer knows that, I mean, I know that Nausgaard does not remember what he said to his father in 1974. I know that.
Or what he had for breakfast
in 78. No, but he remembers these things. So it's a literary effect and an extremely powerful one. Because one of them, the effects of it is the reader constantly asking themselves, well, is this you? And the frisson of that is very useful. It can be manipulated, just like one key amongst many that you play.
In fact, it to such a degree that you get to the end of the novel and there's a scene in which Daryl Pinkney arrives.
Yes, I put Daryl in.
A real-life person who we both know.
Yeah.
And James Fenton.
Yeah, that was the only real folk. It was the thrill of doing it, of entering them into the fiction. Also the voraciousness of fiction, right, that it can eat up reality.
And do whatever it wants.
And do whatever it wants. It is like a fundamentally immoral form, right? You have to deal with its impurity. It's why it makes people uncomfortable a lot of the time.
Said you wrote a remarkable article for the New York Review of Books some years ago called Speaking in Tongues, and it was about being multi-voiced. And it was, at first, it was about Obama's ability to be multi-voiced, the way he would speak in a black church on the south side of Chicago, and then he would speak in deeper southern Illinois to what we now call the white working class. That's also part of you. It's also part of you as a person and as a writer, and maybe it's part of all of us in some way or another. Now that Obama is leaving office, how do you look back on that article and how your evaluation of him and how well or not he used that ability to be multi-voiced to confront that huge issue of race?
I think his instinct to please many people at the same time or to speak to many people at the same time had a certain difficulty, right? Because at a certain point, people want from you a commitment to stand in one place with them. And I think he's constitutionally incapable of doing that. There have been moments in the church when he spoke and sang.
In Charleston.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me because I always thought of him as a writer first, of having a writer mentality. But
he disappointed you as a leader?
No, he never. I think there is no person who will ever take up that office, probably in my lifetime, who I admire more. That's never going to happen. But the person I admire, that's not always an effective political figure. But I mean that as a compliment to him as a human.
But where did he let you down? Where did his politics let you down and were not, say, firm enough or clear enough?
I think in times of emergency, and I think for black people in America in the past few years, this has felt like an emergency. The kind of flexibility he prizes doesn't feel like much. We at times needed someone to stand directly with us and lay a line down. And I think that was the problem.
When you talk about it being an emergency, do you get a sense that in the empirical sense that things are worse now?
I think it's about historical time, this incredible impatience. As far as I can see, I'm an outsider, but the African Americans have been asked time and time again to be patient.
Letter from Birmingham Jail is all about that.
Right. It's always
the insistence on not being patient, right. Enough with patience.
To me, it's about generations of wasted talent. That is always my feeling politically, is that you're asking people to waste what is greatest amongst their people, to never even find out what they are capable of. And it feels late in the day to still be making that argument and still seeing generations of young black people not fulfilling their capacity.
Zadie, when you finish a book, as you have now, you give yourself a break? Do you breathe?
I'm trying to give myself a break. And this time I'm just trying to be in the world. You know, go and pick up my kids, sit in Washington Square, go and see some culture, do something. Writing is a real way of controlling pleasure, someone suggested to me recently, and I think it's very true. It's a strange person who takes it up.
Sadie, you've talked about the business of writing as, in the end of ends, an act for you of disappointment. And I just wonder if you ever finish a book and you have some feeling of deeper satisfaction, that you can at some level admit to yourself that you've written the book that you wanted to write.
No, this time I do have it, much more than before.
For the first time?
Definitely for the first time.
Is it the book or you grew up in some way?
Maybe both. I heard Saffron Foa speaking yesterday at my place of work, and he said something smart about wanting to be known, that both readers and writers want this. And it's a great temptation every day to present yourself in a way that doesn't allow for that. But I did feel, particularly in the shape of these sentences, that I got closer to something that I wanted and that was more honest. So I'm happy. But I'm always happiest, to be honest, reading. That is the pleasure source for me.
Writing is the thing you bring a lunch bucket to, and it's the job that allows you to be liberated to read and be with your family and friends? You're going to do one of these things again. I'm patting the novel
I think I'll always write. The novel doesn't have to, even as a form, it doesn't have to continue forever, you know. It's like late in the day of the novel. I was with a lot of teenagers last summer, and one of them was writing a novel which had quite a large audience on a phone app. And she already had, like, not just hundreds, but thousands of people reading this thing. I don't think our model, the thing we both grew up with.
Pages, ink, 400 pages.
But it's not, to me, it's not a sad matter. Like, we're not going to live that much. You know, we're going to die in 30 to 40 years.
I'm going to live forever. Pomegranate gym, et cetera.
But New Yorkers will live forever. Yes. But for the rest of us, we're going to die.
Sorry that'll
not
happen.
Too long time. If they just, we mosey along together till the end of this, that's fine with me. But the kids will be on a different track altogether.
Ah, the kids. Thanks.
Thank you.
Zadie Smith's new book is called Swing Time, and you can find everything she's written for The New Yorker, including a fantastic profile of the comedy team Key and Peele, at newyorkerradio.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.